Hello and welcome to the January 12th edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I'm Romeo Kratsky, and beside me is my colleague Anthony Bartaway.
Hello, hello.
Today we'll be talking about the latest on the front lines, including the sort of shift to the town of Solidar in the Donbas, as well as a pretty massive attack that Ukraine conducted on Makiivka, and the latest in arms transfers to Ukraine. Now, a quick note before we start, some of our regular listeners might notice that I am actually back. I did intend to be to have my coming back episode actually before New Year's, but unfortunately, our audio for that episode did not turn out presentable, to say the least. So instead of that, I'm back now. And speaking of being back, Anthony, what's the latest on the front?
Yeah, well, first it should usually bring up like the, I guess, home front, we call it. We haven't had an episode since New Year. So I think the biggest bit of news that has happened since then has, at least within Kyiv, has been there was a number of days around New Year's before and after. We talked about it the last episode, of a lot of rocket attacks and a lot of drone attacks, suicide drones. I had the interesting experience of having a few of the drones fly over my apartment. I think it was January 3rd or somewhere around there, where because of the way that I'm kind of positioned in the city, I'm next to the river. In most places in the city, when there's like anti-aircraft guns shooting down the drones, they shoot like pretty much straight up in the air because otherwise they'll hit a building or something. Whereas for me, because I'm right next to the river, they're able to shoot from a very long distance away. So like just above the river surface, going past my window, essentially just tons of anti-aircraft fire. That was, I guess that kind of became my New Year's fireworks.
That doesn't sound too conducive to a good night's sleep.
No, I did not sleep that night. No, it was very loud. the drones themselves are loud. The anti-aircraft fire is loud. I mean, it's always weird to complain about this because it's so much easier here than it is in, say, you know, Kharkiv, Mykolaiv.
Also, it is better for these things to be actually intercepted than strike.
Oh, yeah. So every one of those drones was shot down, to be clear. It was a complete victory by Ukrainian air defense that all, I want to say, about a dozen drones in that one attack. I think 20 even. And they're all destroyed. I actually watched one of them be destroyed, watching the anti-aircraft fire go into the sky, followed by an explosion in the sky. But note to everyone, if there is this kind of battle going on, don't look out your window like I did. This is actually the worst place to be. So don't do that.
Yeah, you probably do want to be in a in an air raid shelter in these sorts of situations, because these kind of autonomous drones, they sort of can hit anywhere. And it doesn't, like, the Russians like to try and strike power facilities, but they've hit kindergartens, random people's apartments. So there's no guarantee that you won't become a target for any reason. Though I can definitely echo a little bit of what you're saying. I think it was not too long after New Year's, I think maybe on the 3rd. There's a very loud blast outside my apartment window, and it was close enough to set off pretty much all the car alarms in the area. So that kind of thing is a good reminder that the war is going on.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah, precisely.
Oh, no, it's been a while since it's been on. Do you have any updates on your own end that you want to talk about before getting into the combat update?
I had a really good speech that I gave for what was supposed to be the New Year's episode that I won't repeat now. But that's the biggest update. I'm upset that our dear listeners will not be subjected to how good that speech. It was a very good speech. If I am to brag a little bit, to toot my own horn, as it were, it was a very good speech. But other than that, no, it's a new year. The war is still going on. So it kind of all feels like one continuous chunk of time.
Yeah. And you've all heard me these past few episodes, so no need for me to dwell on any longer for my own stuff. So just into the combat update. Now, we've been talking about how the battle for Bakhmut specifically has been the main focus of the war, but had not seen much change in really 6 months. It has been an excruciating slog. A lot of people have died. Just all the time on different social media sites, you see alerts of a few of my neighbors in my neighborhood Facebook group, for example, have been killed in Bakhmut recently. It is a horrible, horrible time, but it had largely gone unchanged. As I've kind of expressed in last episodes, I always began, as always, Bakhmut hasn't changed. But now Russian tactics in the area have gained some real traction in that they've really kind of gone back and forth between hitting Bakhmut directly and going to the north of it or going to the south of it. Basically, when they get exhausted in one area, they switch it up. And this has changed on really a week to week, almost day to day basis. And this time when they went north to Soledar, they actually saw a lot of success to the point where, as of the time we're recording, which is the evening of the 11th, this may have completely changed by the time I edit it, and it may be completely changed by the time you hear it. But as of right now, Soledar has, most of the city has fallen to Russia. They are able to move in on the southeast of the city. So think of it as a city that is oriented from northwest to southeast. So they're able to take the southeast part of the city in a extreme offensive push. Really, the numbers of people involved here have been obscene. Special forces, artillery, aviation, absolutely every element that Russia has available to it thrown at this one town that is actually quite small. It's about half the size of my suburb in the U.S. I looked it up. We are really talking about a city that is very, very small in area, industrial. It is a mining town. So a lot of these updates about it have to be talking about, say, the battles around the salt mine. Soledar, the soul means salt. Like, that's the translation.
And I want to know if people look up images prior to the war. So this is not a large place, and the assets that Russia has committed to it, including the Wagner Mercenary Company, which we'll get to their role in this whole affair in a bit. But the assets that Russia has committed to it is really ridiculous, considering that Soledar and even Bakhmut are not the most important or the most strategically important locations in Donbass.
Yeah, so very small town. These mines, though, are before the outbreak of the full scale invasion, pretty much your standard box of salt would be the box of salt that's branded from this town. So it's quite iconic in that way. And within the mines, there's health spas and there's a hotel down there. But the main importance of Soledar is that it is the northern approach to Bakhmut. So as far as strategic concerns go, Soledar itself, it's rough to say considering the amount of death that is going to defend it, but its strategic purpose is as a defense of Bakhmut. And right now, Bakhmut's strategic purpose is as a defense of Slovyansk. So as the city could possibly be falling, now that there's still incredibly intense fighting going on in the city, large parts of the center are still being held by Ukraine. Though, keep in mind that everything that we might know about the ongoing Battle of Soledar is unreliable at best and full-on propaganda at worst. Russia has been claiming for the last several days that they have taken the city entirely, which is demonstrably false. Whereas Ukraine has been a bit Pollyanna about saying that, oh, we still hold in the city, when the indicators seem to be that it is slowly losing. But again, we have no way of knowing anything. Yeah,
the fog of war here is in the full effect. At the end of the day, you can make estimations and guesses based on geolocated videos and photos, but there is no accurate news coming out of that sector. Anything coming out of any side is going to be pretty much shot through with propaganda. So we're going to have to wait until the dust settles to really make an accurate statement about anything that's going on in Soledar.
Yes, and if Saldar falls, then it makes the battle for Bakhmut more difficult, in that allows Russia a larger ability to attack from the northerly direction. But at the same time, that front line right there is basically just a straight line running from north to south. There's not a great like pocket that Russia is working in or anything. So it doesn't make as big of a change as some of the propaganda is saying that it would, I think, is about as far as I'm willing to go with that.
Military evaluation. And we'll add that statements from the Ukrainian military and Ukrainian soldiers who say that they're in the area say that military command has reinforced defense lines behind Soledar, that they have been resupplying and redeploying units to secure the city and really that line from Bakhmut to Soledar better. So it seems like the defense is being reinforced, or at least according to the Ukrainian side.
The main point that the Ukrainian command seems to be able to get across right now is that even if the town falls, they want it to be as pyrrhic of a victory as possible for the Russians. They want them to bleed for every single inch. And that's kind of what's happening. They're climbing over thousands of Russian corpses in order to take this town. It's being turned into a very, very costly possible victory for Russia in this one sector that, again, is a setup for a battle, which is a setup for a battle.
And I think we should talk about here why exactly Russia is committing just so many resources to, and not to say an unimportant front, but as you keep mentioning, Anthony, the setup to a setup to a setup. And the reasoning has a lot to do with one Yevgeny Prigozhin, the owner of the Russian Wagner mercenary company. And the reason he wants to take Bakhmut is because there is a bit of an influence war or reputation jockeying occurring in the Kremlin right now. It's no secret that Russian dictator Vladimir Putin has not been happy with the performance of his Ministry of Defense in the 10 months of war. I mean, this was, after all, intended to be a 3-day special operation. And Russia's generals and the Ministry of Defense have not shown that they are up to the task of achieving even the slightest of victories in Ukraine this far.
And I'll jump in here to say that the overall commander of Russian forces, Surovikin, was replaced today or yesterday as you're hearing this, and is being replaced by Gerasimov. So Surovikin, who was brought in as, you know, this iron-hearted destroyer of the Syrian opposition, for the last several months that he's been in command, he's been doing nothing but losing. So he just got a demotion to a lower level command, whereas Gerasimov, who is a bit more famous to people, like the Gerasimov doctrine, some people may have heard of, although whatever, not important conversation, but he's being repositioned as the head of this person who is on one hand a bit more comfortable as far as overall operations. He has been very high up in the Russian military for a very long time, and also as this kind of ideological kind of Kremlin appendage, whereas Surovikin was just a military man, but of course a military man who failed.
And Surovikin is literally just the latest in the line to fail. In fact, you can start a betting pool on how long it is before Gerasimov's replaced, though at some point Russia's going to run out of generals to command this operation in Ukraine. But all of this is to say that Putin hasn't been happy with the Ministry of Defense, with the Russian armed forces, with the traditional military structure. But there are kind of two other military powers in Russia that have been operating in Ukraine. And I wouldn't say that they've had more success, but they've had better PR at the very least. And this is the Wagner Mercenary Company and the Kadyrovites, the household troops or the personal troops of Chechen warlord Ramzan Kadyrov. This main push in Soledar has been in large part due to Yevgeny Prigozhin, the Wagner owner's want to show that his fighting force is the most effective in Russia. As the traditional military has kind of lost favor with the Führer, with the Tsar, other military powers have realized that they can get a really good word in. And there are even rumors that Prigozhin himself is aiming for the Minister of Defense position, though Kremlinology is not something that I recommend people delve into. But in any case, this influence jockeying has resulted in Prigozhin really staking his reputation, the Wagner mercenary company reputation, on taking Bakhmut, on taking Soledar. If they do take it, while yes, it does make it easier to assault Bakhmut, it might make the situation there a little less tense for the Russians, the real effect would be the influence boost that Prigozhin would receive from that conquest, basically, as well as the morale boost to the Russian population. If you're a regular listener to this podcast, you might have heard us use the term Russian military bloggers pretty often. And the significance of that might not be clear. Because information is so tightly controlled in Russia and is so tightly regulated by the state, a lot of people receive their information from unofficial sources, these military bloggers. A lot of these guys, of course, just make stuff up wholesale, but a lot of them are military or formal military who may or may not be on the front lines, and their opinions seem to have an impact on the Kremlin itself. Russian military bloggers have, of course, not been happy with the official story that Russia has been putting out for quite a while now. Whenever even they make fun of the constant Kremlin claims of having destroyed the 50th Ukrainian HIMARS unit or downed the 25th Ukrainian fighter jet. And they make the same jokes that we do. That's 50 out of 18. but that shows that there are people in Russia that at least are willing to acknowledge the reality of the situation, that they are not doing well in this war, that is just not working out for them. But if they were able to take Soledar, if they are able to take Bakhmut, their opinion would rapidly increase, and likely Russian morale as a whole would go up significantly. Wars are, of course, fought in the mines just as much as the battlefields, and morale has a significant and immediate effect on combat performance, something the Russians have been learning, though in the negative sense, throughout these past 10, 11 months.
Yevgeny Prigozhin, if he manages to take Soledar with, you know, all the asterisks and kvats that we already discussed, that means that he really would have achieved the only Russian victory since June with the fall of Severodonetsk, which he also kind of took some credit for, but no.
He is taking complete credit for all the progress that Russia has made in Soledar, to the point where he has officially claimed on Wagner Telegram channels that Wagner units are the only units present in that sector, which A, isn't true, and B, has actually brought veiled kickback from the Kremlin, with Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov saying, in response to a question about how well Wagner has been doing in Soledar, said that, well, we still need time to see. So, again, I do not advocate anyone engage in Kremlinology, but when forced to, I would say that represents, let's say, if not concern in the Kremlin and understanding in the Kremlin of what Prigozhin is trying to accomplish with these boasts about Soledar and why he's committing so many resources there.
Yeah, the journalistic term for when you don't know the exact nature of a conflict but want to say that exists is we can say that there is some friction between the Ministry of Defense and Wagner Group. There's the friction there that the exact details we don't know and can evolve in different directions. And the other part of this is that Prigozhin really also likes to put himself front and center as being on the front lines. So
he's a salesman.
He's a real salesman. So when we look at, say, the distinction between Zelensky and Putin has been very, very clear. Zelensky has gone to the front lines a lot, while Putin has been in a plastic bubble, not seeing any other people for really the last 2 years, 3 years of his life. In this case, Prigozhin really wants to make it look like he's leading from the front. There is one photo of him in what he claimed was the Soledar salt mines, even though there's no actual salt in the picture, which is a pretty clear indicator he wasn't quite there. He might have been in a nearby mine. Who knows where he actually was? But he wanted to show himself as being this kind of general leading the charge into the city by his own. And that can buy a lot of clout. Again, so there has been this frustration on the Russian side that Putin has been so completely distant from everything, and how the generals have really led from miles and miles away, except for, in the early days of the war, when some of them would come to the front to kind of beat someone with a stick and then get sniped. So there's a reason why they're staying away from the front, because so many of them were killed early on. But it is a necessary part of morale to see that your leaders are with you. Now, when it comes to on-the-ground realities, that's not truly the case. There is a lot of analysis going on that says that these convict units that Wagner is using are basically just handed a tablet with a map on it that says, follow this line, go from point A to point B, without really any officers leading them. And then that obviously gets a lot of them killed. Whereas it almost feels like a video game, whereas the higher officers are commanding their lower ranked soldiers with just these tablets that have the map on it, like a HUD in RTS.
I would say it's more modernized Napoleonic warfare, where the kind of the elite officer class, though in Russia, I do want to make it clear, most officers are just as miserable and poorly treated as the enlisted. It's only the ones at the very top who have access to budgets and contracts that enjoy anything like respect or a good life or good living. And almost everyone else is in the shit. But this kind of idea of these distant aristocratic soldiers with less than zero regard for the lives of their men, telling them, sending them on idiotic missions with no information and no backup. I think that's what we're seeing here, because these guys couldn't care less. I mean, again, Wagner is already a mercenary company, so they're already not exactly interested in the lives of the soldiers of misfortune that fight for them. And on top of that, these are literal press ganged convicts, which means their lives are in every single sense expendable for everyone.
Yeah. So altogether, we have this situation where Prigozhin, one, is looking for literally the only victory since the summer, and two, him personally leading the front, the charge, or at least from a PR perspective, he wants people to see him as leading it from the front, even though that's not the case. And looking to a post-war scenario, on one hand, yes, this is buying him a lot of clout within any kind of, court politics that may arise. But also, specifically, it means that if he takes Bakhmut, which the trends are not exactly going in his favor, even if Soledar is taken. But if everything goes his way and he does manage to take Bakhmut, and maximal situation happens and they're able to hold on to that area post-war, what Wagner does in his activities in Africa is that they trade their services mainly for resource concessions, cobalt, diamonds, all that kind of thing. What they do is they buy the rights to, they are awarded with the rights to these mines, and that's what a lot of their payment is. So this Bakhmut area, Soledar, the salt mine, Bakhmut, there's lots of different minerals in this area. They would get the resource concessions. Now, they actually have to win first, but that's what they're looking for.
Though, again, dealing with the Russian government, which presumably would have its own ideas of what to do with these mines, is likely a little bit different than dealing with Central African warlords. But we'll see. Prigozhin has his ambitions, and Soledar seems to be a pretty important part of those ambitions.
Yes, moving on to what Ukraine has been doing more on the assault front. And there has been, again, since around New Year, while Russia was sending all of its missiles and suicide drones, there was a large campaign on the Ukraine side to destroy Russian barracks and Russian, you know, ammo depots, that kind of thing. The largest of these happened in Makiivka. It's a city that pretty much directly abuts Donetsk. It's quite large. It's kind of a singular urban area. So in Makiivka, there was a fairly large Russian barracks. This was formerly a college of some kind, I think it was. But once the Russians came in, they decided to transform it into a barracks. Now, there were, you know, roughly 400 people in this barracks when it was hit by a HIMARS. They were there for a New Year's celebration, actually, and a lot of them were ordered to be in the building at the time. Now, it was destroyed. The building, the pictures of it, when I say destroyed, this thing was leveled entirely. So the odds of anyone surviving it were quite low. Now, Ukraine says that 400 Russian soldiers were killed in this barracks attack. Russia says it was only 89, but that is a lot of wishful thinking, it seems, on their part.
And they do want to remind our listeners of what the Russian story with the Moskva was, which first didn't sink, and second, did not lose nearly the entire complement of its crew.
But yeah, just looking at this building, though, if anyone was able to survive, there were some survivors we know who were interviewed about what happened in whatever horrific state they were found in. But that building doesn't exist anymore, partially because apparently the Russians were also using it as a munitions magazine. They were keeping a lot of their explosive equipment within the same building they were sleeping in, which is a bad idea.
This is one of the things the Russian military bloggers have really seized on as kind of emblematic of the corruption and incompetence of the Russian Ministry of Defense, is the fact that some commander somewhere decided to house a barracks in the same place as the munitions dump, and no one caught on or cared enough to countermand or amend those orders. This has obviously been not something that Russian nationalists, Russia, people who Russian patriots, you could even say, are very happy with. And to be honest, I think it's perfectly believable that the casualties that Ukraine claims to have inflicted did in fact happen. I mean, barracks do house hundreds of soldiers, and we've seen countless examples of Russian stupidity to where I could fully believe some genius decided to store all the bombs in the same building as everyone was sleeping.
Yeah, so on the point of, and there are a few other similar attacks, but that was the biggest one. But on the point of these kind of Russian nationalist commentators, they were very, very mad about this. Like, they were furious within their, you know, various Telegram channels and different outlets that they use. And Russia decided to kind of assuage their anger by saying that they blew up a Ukrainian barracks with 600 people in it. Now, there was a follow-up investigation here. I said that people went to the site of this Makiivka barracks that was blown up, photographs of it, and were able to show it was annihilated. When someone did the same thing to this Ukrainian barracks in Kramatorsk, actually, there was nothing to be found. There was an empty, abandoned building and two craters in front of it. So not only did they not hit a barracks of what they claimed, they did not hit anything. It was the grounds in front of an abandoned building that was otherwise damaged, of course, by different challenges and all that, but
it wasn't leveled. Did it have evidence that there were 600 living people in that building prior to these explosions?
A complete lie. An absolute complete lie. And I don't think that these Russian nationalist commentators would be satisfied with it because it was such an obvious lie. That doesn't, of course, stop the international press from breathlessly repeating the Russian propaganda as if it was true, with the other kind of journalistic, rat words of saying Russia claims 600 Ukrainian soldiers killed in barrack strike,
which really doesn't give you a good sense of how much evidence falls on one claim or the other.
Yeah, this infuriated me. I was seeing all these headlines from quote unquote respected outlets just saying that this attack happened when all proof said that it didn't, and then just giving the little explainer that, oh, Ukraine denies that it happened. Well, we can check on this, you know. You can do journalism, you do reporting, and say that this happened or it didn't happen. You don't have to just go off of repeating Russian claims, because then just people say Russia claims this, and then they might have something in the back of their mind, oh no, everyone lies. But they still see that second thing of, oh, barracks destroyed, and it kind of fits in the entire purpose of this propaganda. It's obscene.
Unfortunately, it is a habit of the way the, especially Western media has developed in the past few decades, to make sure that every side has its quote unquote say, regardless of the evidence or validity of those views when expressed. But moving on from the lamentable failures of the mainstream media to keep people properly informed, let's talk about arms transfers.
Now, this next topic we want to talk about is a pretty big influx in the ability of Ukraine to receive more military aid of various kinds. Now, this has been a serious concern that Ukraine has been having. On one hand, there has been this concern about being able to actually resupply the kind of old equipment that Ukraine has been using. Most of the ammunition, most of the weapons that Ukraine has been using has been Soviet-made, being pulled from these very old stockpiles the country had. Same with Russia. This is a war being fought with mainly like 50-year-old technology in a lot of cases. Now, the problem with that is you kind of run into this with a lot of different technology. If your old appliance breaks, there's the part that needs to be used to fix it. It just doesn't exist anymore. And this was the big question that had to do with artillery shells. Now, these artillery shells were built for these very old artillery pieces. Now, you can swap them in and out in a lot of cases, but there has been a serious supply problem in that way. America has been going all over the place to try and find these older model ammunition. It has scraped up what it could from the military stockpiles of Eastern Europe, who, because they're part of the communist bloc, use the same types of weapons that are being used now. And the big breakthrough that just happened was that it seems as though a munitions plant in Romania, a few of them, are able to produce everything that Ukraine needs in this regard, and it just needs to be kind of refitted and get the assembly line going again. And this agreement was made with the Romanian government that they would do so. America is helping them out with this. There will be they'll be paid for it, of course. But this problem of Ukraine having to worry about eventually running out entirely of artillery shells, that seems to have been assuaged for now. Now, of course, there's still the problem of how fast these factories can get up and running, how many they'll be able to produce right off the bat, how long Ukraine will have to wait to get like a constant supply going. but it seems as though Romania is really pulling through as to be the arsenal of democracy in this case. Romania, of course, has been a serious helper in other dimensions as well. All kinds of military equipment has come out of Romania. They've been a diplomatic supporter. They're a very close friend of Ukraine. So it's very nice to see them being able to find this new way to help the country. Of course, they are another Black Sea nation, which is strategically very important as far as dealing with Russia is concerned. A lot of this fighting has been for Russia to be kind of a Black Sea power monopoly, which scares the NATO countries who also share the Black Sea space. There's also the question of Romania's very close ties to Moldova, and Moldova is partially occupied by Russia in the form of Transnistria. So in all these ways, Romania aligns with Ukrainian interests, and they'll likely step this up in various ways in the coming year, as it seems as though various countries throughout Europe are now kind of turning on some of the avenues of support that they had previously decided was too politically problematic. This mostly has to do with these, armored vehicles. So on one hand, we have to look at the United States. Now, the United States passed a recent aid bill to send a lot of stuff to Ukraine. And if you look at what's actually in the list of these equipment, you kind of see what the priority was here. Now, it included a lot of, you know, the old stuff, ammunition for HIMARS, that kind of thing. But there is a new focus on these armored vehicles. Now, this package includes Bushmasters, which had been used already, but also the Bradley fighting vehicle. It is an infantry fighting vehicle that is pretty well armored. There's been some complaints about it by American soldiers and Marines in Iraq. It has not 100% perfect reputation as far as maintenance goes, but it is a very powerful weapons platform. If you look at France is also sending the AMX-10RC. This is a wheeled vehicle, so it's not technically a tank. So the internet arguments of what is or is not a tank comes into play right now. But it is mainly a tank killer. So we have these Bradleys, which are used to support infantry assaults, along with these tank-killing armored vehicles. So really what Ukraine has been asking for and what it is now receiving are these very strong offensive capabilities that are needed to really assault positions. Now, throughout all this time, Ukraine was able to kind of play the defense, wait out Russia in various areas where it ran out of supplies. Like with Kherson, it was a siege mentality where they just kind of surrounded the Russian position, waited for them to run low on supply, destroy their infrastructure, their supply routes, their warehouses, and wait, just make it impossible for Russia to stay where it was. But Ukraine has always had a severe difficulty in actually pushing forward its own offensive assaults because it just did not have this equipment. Now, what it has been asking for the most has been tanks, which it has not received yet, but I'll get into that in a moment. But these armored vehicles are a serious step forward in being able to really bring the fight to the enemy in the spring, possibly summer offensives that are being planned.
And I do want to mention that there has been now a movement to actually provide Ukraine with modern battle tanks. The British say that they are exploring ways to send Challenger 2 tanks to Ukraine. Poland has indicated that it wants to send some of its German-made Leopard tanks to Ukraine. And while Germany is continuing to equivocate on the issue of sending tanks to Ukraine or not, the stated German reason, this refrain that they keep on saying, is they want to act in coordination with their allies. Well, if Poland and the UK and other nations begin to send these modern battle tanks to Ukraine? Well, that would be this coordination with allies that Germany is looking for. So they are slowly running out of excuses to continue to delay these shipments.
And the reason why some of these other countries were not able to send their own main battle tanks was because they are these Leopards who were provided by Germany. So they have to get permission from Germany to send them forward on to a third country. And they've been very cagey about this. Like you just said, they keep on saying that they don't want to be the only ones sending tanks to Ukraine, even though like they would love to do it, but they don't want to be standing there on their own making unilateral escalatory decisions, which on the surface makes sense as an argument. Why should they be the only ones sending tanks? If people are going to send tanks, they should all send tanks. Well, now other people are probably going to start sending tanks, and within a reasonable time frame. So once it kind of breaks that taboo of not sending tanks, once one person or once one country does it, then everyone else will do it as well, or at least everyone else who has the capability to do it will do it as well. So all this together looks like Ukraine has a lot of very good prospects going forward as far as its type of armament, as well as its quantity of armaments in the form of those artillery shells, which are, I can't explain to you how important having enough artillery shells is. We've gone over it before, but being able to shoot as many shells at the enemy as the enemy is shooting at you or more is what decides a lot of these battles. And there has also been this concern that there would be Ukraine fatigue coming into the coming year, that Ukraine's Western allies are distracted by various economic concerns, by political concerns. And it seems as though that's just not the case. And they are, in fact, doing the opposite. They are increasing their amount of support to Ukraine. Part of the celebratory Russian propaganda about this would be, there's a hilarious propaganda video that came out of Russia recently of, you know, these Europeans in Paris and Berlin, you know, freezing to death in the winter with no food. And well, we're deep into this first winter of the war, and none of these doom and gloom predictions that were made have come true at all.
Shocker that Russian propaganda turns out to be false once again.
So this Ukraine fatigue just really isn't showing up. And
if I had to speculate on why, I would say a big reason seems to be a growing realization in Europe, especially, that there will never again be return to business with Russia, that Russia has isolated itself so well and has proven itself to be such a bad faith partner that there is no Russian market for European companies to return to. And I think that's a big reason why Europe in particular has been becoming more bold with supplying Ukraine with modern weapons and not just whatever old Soviet era stocks have been sitting in a warehouse for 30 years. Because once Europe realizes that they can't do business with Russians, and they will likely never be able to do business with Russians as long as Russia exists in its present form, well, suddenly the incentive appears to ensure that Russia stops existing in its current form. And that will happen once the war is won.
Yeah, and the other armored vehicle that's being sent is being sent from Germany. It's called a Mardar. It's another armored fighting vehicle. So again, Germany, who everyone has been extremely critical of for the reasons we just said about them being so hesitant to send tanks and other things, they're on board too. They're just kind of shy about it, I guess. So everything on the diplomatic front is quite sunny, I'd say. And that kind of brings us into our last topic to talk about, which is the new U.S. Congress. And there have been some significant changes as far as the tone coming out of the House of Representatives, at least, due to the Republicans being able to gain a majority, but a very small majority. Now, within this round of midterm elections, there was this big question of this insurgent MAGA Trumpist kind of right wing coming in and possibly, you know, overthrowing the old Republican establishment, which has largely been supportive of Ukraine, but not entirely. Now, that just didn't happen. A lot of these people just lost, and in some cases, they lost running on criticizing Ukraine support. But not really. Most of that is just tied to if someone is super critical of Ukraine support, then they're also likely to, for example, want to make 100% of their political position about like hating trans kids or something like that. So there's a lot of conflating factors. You can't say that they lost because they were against Ukraine, but it all is kind of bundled in with a bunch of other nasty stuff. Contested fight over the Speaker of the House position. That kind of showed how disunited this House of Representatives will be. And there is some indication that the deal to put McCarthy as the Speaker of the House had something to do with throttling aid to Ukraine, but that hasn't really borne out yet. We'll have to see where that goes. We are not an American political podcast. We have our own opinions about that stuff, but that's not really our main topic. But it is very important to pay attention to how formerly the U.S. Congress was both parties very much supportive of Ukraine, except for this small faction within the Republicans who are very loud, very, very far right, very, very pro-Russia. Now that the Republicans are in the House, it will throw into doubt how much support will go to Ukraine. But again, it's such a small majority they have. The Democrats still back us. The votes are there. By far, the votes are still there in the House in order to fund Ukraine. And the Senate, the Democrats actually gained a bit. So we'll have to see where this fight within the Republican Party goes, what they're willing to do in order to appease this far-right faction. Lots of questions for the future.
A lot of it is going to depend on the promises that the new House Speaker McCarthy made to the far right faction in order to finally win their support and win the vote for Speaker. So until those answers are seen, until those answers are observed, it's going to be difficult to say how the Republican Party as a whole is going to vote regarding Ukraine. Though I will say this historically, for despite the very common refrain from the American right of America first and American isolationism, there has typically been a bipartisan consensus when it comes to sending aid to partner nations. So historically, it's unlikely that they are going to act out of character, but at the same time, this is the modern GOP we're talking about, not the GOP of the 80s or the 70s. And this GOP is rapidly becoming a very different beast from the Republican Party that we've seen in the past.
Yeah, so we're looking at this small faction: Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, Paul Gosar. Within in the Senate, the main person acting this way has been Rand Paul, and he's in the minority anyway. We're looking at these small number of very hyper ideological, I guess far right kind of pseudo fascists, I want to say, that if they're able to successfully grab a hold of the entirety of the Congress, it doesn't seem like they have that much authority. And the fight for the Speaker of the House has really embittered their colleagues against them. I think it was. Yeah, Mike Rogers almost beat up Matt Gaetz on the floor of the Congress, and that would have been hilarious. And I'm very mad that they stopped him from doing that. But yeah, we'll have to see where that goes.
At the end of the day, the White House and most of the Senate is still behind Ukraine, and public opinion in the U.S. still strongly supports, is still in strong favor of supporting Ukraine. So I doubt this isolationist push or this pro-Russian push by the fascist faction, the GOP, is going to make much of a difference, unless, of course, there is a noticeable shift in public opinion. Though, again, for a lot of the old conservative base that the GOP relies on, their Cold War fantasies are being reenacted right now. And it's hard to imagine that they will that they would discard those fantasies in favor of a pro-Russian agenda anytime soon.
All right. So that's all of our topics for the week. Anything to cap us off with?
Now that our power situation here in Kyiv is sort of stable, we'll be reintroducing some guests to the podcast. We have a few lined up already, but if any of our listeners have ideas or suggestions or requests for guests that they would like to see on the show, then please go ahead and send those in. And don't forget to like, subscribe, sign up for our Patreon if you haven't already and you like our content, and keep supporting Ukraine. Slava Ukraini.
Proям Слава. If you would like to support this podcast, the best thing to do is just share us with your friends, family, share us on social media, give the thumbs up, 5-star ratings, whatever is the mechanism in the app that you use to listen to us. If you'd like to support us financially, you can go to patreon.com/UkraineWithoutHype and join our groups of supporters. And I'd now like to thank our supporters who have donated very kindly to us. And these are Deborah Grazer, Will Stevens, David Shepard, Giorgio, Ivana Kukratskaya, Anna Karen, Anonymous, Devi, Etine, Kevin, Sam Toman, Theo, Adam, Aiden, McDonald, Alex Grochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Big Rob, Brianna Rhoda, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Chris Walker, Crystal Burns, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Eric Honnold, Grace Kraus, Had to Laugh, Jacob Holm, James Wise, Jenny Louise, Jennifer Jarvis, Jerd, Justin Nevendorf, Kristen Swanland, Laura De Leon, Lev Goldener, Levy Grove, Lati, Marguerite Marks, Melissa Koselko, Mike Perrone, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, Randy McNerlin, Sanjay, Scott Grengris, Scott Tarkiuk, Steve Bien, Steven Greenberg, Stuart Akers, T. Bart, Thomas Sobiek, Branik, Vic, and Victoria Leontineva. A few people have joined us in the new year, and thank you very much to our new subscribers as well as the old. And in this coming 2023, just keep supporting Ukraine, sticking it through for this horrific war that has destroyed so many lives. And Slava Ukraini.